I like to do weddings, particularly of young people who are members of this church. And this morning there are two such couples back from honeymoons. I would like to recognize them, and I would like for you to see them. So, Darren and Kimberly Larson, would you stand up, please, so people can see who you are? And Randy and Sue Armstrong in the back, would you do the same? We are very, very happy to have you present. Words are living things. They have biographies. Take the word vignette, for example, which literally means in French, little vine. It was used once to describe the branches, leaves, and grapes drawn as decoration on a manuscript. And by, it expanded its meaning to include any small, pleasing picture, even a small, graceful literary sketch. Well, the Gospels are made up of vignettes, and I was intrigued by a couple of them last week. Jesus sees a man named Matthew sitting at a tax collector's table, and he says, "Follow me," and boom, the man gets up and follows. Small sketch. Too small. Can't be the whole story. A man with a lucrative job in a poor country does not jump up suddenly and run off with an itinerant evangelist unless something has already happened to make that decision likely. The Gospels are outlines rather than histories. And a lot of things we'd like to know are missing. For example, very early in his ministry, Jesus walks by the Lake of Galilee, sees a couple of brothers tossing nets into the water, and says, "Follow me, and I will make you fishers of men." And just like that, they drop their nets and follow. And a bit farther on down the beach, he sees two more brothers in a boat mending their nets and calls them, and up they jump and off they go together. Now, I realize that people in the Near East tend to be more compulsive than we are, but this is too much. And there is a hint in one of the Gospels that Jesus had had some talks with these people before they made their decision, a much more probable scenario. Fishing was big business on the lake, a pretty lake with its clear, fresh water and abundance of fish, but it was also a dangerous place at times, with sudden storms that swept down the valleys on the east shore to swamp boats and drown fishermen. So these were tough, hardy men, not given, I would guess, to sudden decisions about changing their whole way of life. Let's try to make it come to life, which is the only way to read the Bible. How would you like to have been Zebedee, father of James and John, owner and chief proprietor of Zebedee and Sons Fishing Company of Capernaum on the lake? You are from hardworking, blue-collar local stock, respected by just about everybody, hailed on the street corner as good old boys, proud of the calluses on your hands that you got from trying to keep bread on the table. You're a skilled fisherman, and you work hard, and you've got these two boys to whom you'd like to pass on the boat and the nets someday, so that every day you try to teach them what real work is and what making a living is. And like all boys, they work in spurts, and the rest of the time they complain or daydream about a girl or even occasionally mumble that thing under their breath that you dread above all else to hear. Maybe I don't want to be a fisherman all my life. Imagine that you are this Zebedee, and one morning when you were dry docked and scrubbing down the deck while the boys mend some tears in the net, this strolling rabbi happens along and says, "Follow me." And these two boys of yours drop the nets and without so much as a goodbye, shuffle down the road after him. Can that be the whole story? Or take the text read this morning about Matthew, sitting at work when the rabbi comes by and says, "Follow me," and Matthew just gets up and goes without putting the change box away, without stopping at the water cooler for a drink, without so much as a note home to say he is headed somewhere, he'll get in touch later. Surely not. These are big decisions, and you have to wonder if the stories haven't gotten a little better and a little more compact with the telling, on purpose perhaps, to make Jesus seem all the more irresistible. Isn't it a whole lot more likely that there were some long and heated talks between the fishermen's sons and their father? You want to follow which man? To do what? And isn't it more likely that Jesus had passed that toll booth of Matthew's many times and stopped to chat? "Morning, Matthew. Is this a pretty good job?" How do the people feel about the tax they have to pay to the Romans through you? And then actually listening while Matthew gets over his surprise and talks, amazed to find a friendly face after all those other people he saw every day who cursed him for a traitor when they got 10 steps out of his sight and spat on the ground in disgust as if it were his face. So the rough and ready fisherman and the white-collar worker, who if not an actual crook, was certainly thought by everybody to be one, drop everything and become disciples. But the full story, if we had it, would undoubtedly have had those earlier talks with Jesus asking, "Is this what you really want to do with your lives?" And talking about a whole new order of life, a kingdom of new relationships among people, so compelling that Matthew starts to dream about it at night and the four fishermen in the daytime while they hunt the schools of fish, until all of them decide quite abruptly one day to do something about it. And it is a surprise only to people who haven't been able to see the thought processes at work for weeks and maybe months. There was a man who ultimately became Poet Laureate of England, John Masefield, who once in his life was doing a job about as romantic as Matthew's, working as a mistake finder in a carpet mill, looking for those little snags and defects, terribly miscast, until one day he bought a copy of Chaucer and started reading the Canterbury Tales. You remember the melodic sound of it. Quandat aprile with his shore sota, the drochre march hath pierced to the rota, and bathed every vein in swish liqueur, of which vertu engendered is the fleur, and so on. And the simple fact is that either this is magic or it isn't. And either your heart leaps up at the glory of words or it doesn't. And that all depends on a few hundred other things that have already made you a certain kind of person. And to John Masefield, the sky split from one horizon to another, and his head filled up with sweet thunder, and by he bought a copy of Keats to go with Chaucer, and read that long and late, and finally said, I knew then that my law was to follow poetry even if I died of it. Now, if these Gospels we read were more than just outlines, if we had the full story, aren't you convinced that it went something like that for Matthew too? Tired of the bookkeeping, tired of having people look at him as if he were scum on a pond, tired of shabby little shortcuts and cheating, wanting desperately to find some great loyalty, and then beginning to be captivated by the talks he had with this Jesus of Nazareth, who was not like the others, until one day that compelling personality said, follow me, with the implied promise of romance and meaning in life. So he makes the big decision suddenly, which is exactly how we make some of the truly big decisions in life. We may sit and talk forever about whether to go to the Rockies or the Carolinas on vacation, to change the couch or to replace the lamp. But on the crucial choices, we often decide quickly, and we get the feeling, not that we acted on blind impulse with no preparation, but that this is actually the moment our whole lives have been preparing for. We'll be doctor, nurse, attorney, businessman, teacher, and we may even speak of it as our calling. I have a little skepticism about some of these dramatic stories I hear of how ministers get called. I have a hunch those stories, too, get better in the telling. I think I could be creative enough to dress it up, but my own lifetime choice was made quietly, at least at the time I thought it was made. Although I realize now it was probably made long before I knew it. I was taken to church as a child. I was never asked if I wanted to go. If I had said, I think I'll just stay here this morning, my dad would have smiled as if a gentle lunatic had just said something not quite intelligible. and repeated the schedule. We'll be leaving in 15 minutes. So I heard sermons and was often bored, like any normal boy, but went so often, and I heard a great many things in spite of my boredom and my eagerness to distract myself. And by, I began to be fascinated by which preacher got a hearing and which didn't, and why, and became a sort of cocky little connoisseur of sermons, I suppose. And there was some idealism in me from somewhere, and so one night we drove over to a nondescript little town in an easily forgettable little church and heard a man preach, and I listened to every word, and I knew that night that I wanted to be a wordsmith. I couldn't sing or play more than the harmonica, but I wanted to make words dance and know all the multicolored words there were and put them in combinations and make ideas sprout out of them. And speaking to an audience seemed the way to do that. On the way home that night from the back seat at about the age of 12 or 13, I told my folks that's what I wanted to do. I don't think they paid much attention. I was too young to know. But I did, as it turned out. Although years later, when I met some great teachers, I simply fused those two professions, which have always seemed pretty much the same thing to me anyway. And so it goes with our decisions. Whatever romantic love is, it hits, and you say, yes, this is the person I love, and for this person I am willing to alter my life. Because, like Frost's road, you choose it, and one day you realize that however much it looked like any other road, traveling that one has made all the difference. Or you are Mahatma Gandhi, and the moment comes when you're kicked off a train in South Africa, and you realize that the world is set up for certain kinds of people with certain pigments in their skin, and you decide which thing you're going to do, and the decision you make is that you will follow forever the vision of changing that. Are you a Martin Luther King? And some people decide to stop riding on the back of the bus in Montgomery, and all of a sudden your whole life changes, except, of course, it has been changing for a long time, and you just did not know it. Now, I have to assume that in some way or other, to some degree, everyone in this room has heard another voice that says, follow me. And that this is, at least is a part of why you're present. It doesn't have to have been a voice like thunder, or a neon sign flashing from the top of a skyscraper. It could just start out as a kind of gnawing dissatisfaction with the way things are. Maybe a call to simplify life, heard late in the day, often, when we think how much closer to our families we might feel, if ambition did not always take precedence over relationships. Or more shattering yet, a call to change jobs or locations, because surely new scenery and new friends will fill the empty space that has never been filled. But the call that can disturb some of us profoundly is the one Christ makes. Because on the surface it seems so old-fashioned and even pointless. Follow me. We read it. We hear it in a song, and some preacher repeats the words, and questions leap to mind. Why? Why follow his way of life? And how far? How much can we take along with us? And what do we get for our trouble? Well, pick just one of those. Where will my following take me? The one thing you can be sure of is that it may not take you where you want to go, but to some place where you are needed, until by a kind of magic, where you are needed becomes the place where you want to go. Sticky places, among the poor and the sick, among the white-collared healthy with their hatreds, that the one you follow would change. You can't follow without some difference in your life. And how far? For that answer, let me close with the words of Frederick Buechner, to whom I am so often and so gladly in debt. They are carefully written. You have to listen carefully. How far do we follow? As far as the hill where the three shadows fall, and the women stand weeping beside them. Only weeping not because we are to be crucified with him, but because we are not to be crucified. Because we guess in advance that we lack the courage unto death. Yet go on anyway, as far as we can. And maybe our shame, our regret, is crucifixion enough. In what manner do we go? I want to say, joyously and proudly, with a spring in our step and banners flying, and sometimes, by God's grace, this is so. But more often than not, we go dragging our feet, wishing that we had never heard the voice that now we can never entirely stop hearing. And finally, who is he? All that we know is the sound of his voice and maybe the lightest touch of his hands on our shoulders. He is the one we are free to follow or not to follow. The one we begin to know fully only by following. As we follow, we become, such as we are, his church. A weak thing in most ways, half-hearted and of little faith, but full of hope for all that. And the only body that he has in this world, the only hands and feet to do his work. What we must never forget, because the day we do, this is no longer a church, holy and lifted up, with a calling and a destiny. What we must never forget is that he is always saying, beneath our friendships, beyond our pride in the simple loveliness of this place, always saying that tantalizing and most painful invitation, follow me. The words that give us the only excuse we have for living here in this room.